It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll look at the life of a Wisconsinite who's the only American woman ordered to be executed by Adolf Hitler.
First, Wisconsin Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner has introduced legislation yesterday aimed at eliminating the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. In a statement, Sensenbrenner called the ATF a largely duplicative, scandal-ridden agency that lacks a clear mission.
Among other things, the agency has come under close scrutiny in recent years after high-profile sting operations gone wrong, including cases in Milwaukee and elsewhere. It's not the first time there's been a legislative call to end that agency, but is this the time it sticks?
Joining us now is John Diedrich. He's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been working on an ongoing investigative series into the ATF called Backfire. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the proposal itself. What does it say?
Well, so this proposal, what it would do is not so much dissolve the ATF, though that language comes up, but really take the parts of the agency that are not duplicated elsewhere and fold them into other agencies. So, for instance, most of the operations of the ATF that involve enforcement of the nation's gun laws and so forth would go to the FBI. There are portions of it that would also go to the DEA and the Treasury Department. And then those parts that duplicate, say, going after violent crime and so forth, that's perhaps duplicated by other agencies, those missions would end.
Okay, well, that takes care of the part of his statement that calls the agency duplicative. The rest of it says it is scandal-ridden and lacking in a clear mission. How does that come into play in this?
Well, the agency's had a series of high-profile problems. Our series, as you alluded to at the beginning, looked at a series of storefront operations. This was a technique that was used not only in Milwaukee but across the country. And what we found is uncovered a series of problems and mistakes that happened throughout. For instance, the operation here in Milwaukee was promoted by an individual who had a low IQ, and this was a factor that came up in operations across the country, individuals with low IQs, mental disabilities, that were used to promote these operations, and then they were turned around and being charged. They arrested some of the wrong people. They ended up increasing crimes in certain areas. An agent in Milwaukee lost his machine gun, which has still not been recovered. So we found a series of problems in the Milwaukee operation, then in operations across the country. And this comes in the wake of the Fast and Furious problem, the Operation Fast and Furious, which has generated a lot of scrutiny into the ATF, and that's where agents in the southwest part of the United States in Arizona watched as a couple thousand weapons passed in the hands of criminals and ultimately ended up at crime scenes, mostly in Mexico, but also at the crime scene where a U.S. border agent was killed.
Now, how big a deal would this be should it pass? And in essence, how many people work at the ATF and what is their budget?
Well, they have about 4,700 employees right now, and they have just over $1 billion budget. What's interesting is the agency is sort of at a crossroads right now in terms of its personnel. About a third of the agency is eligible for retirement, and the agency's had a hard time filling its ranks and keeping up with that attrition rate. So that came up in a GAO report recently. So this would be one of the reasons why Sensenbrenner, Representative Sensenbrenner, and others who are looking at this are suggesting this might be a good time to do this. So in terms of the impact, what we're looking at is a somewhat of a phased-in plan. If this did pass, it would immediately halt the hiring ability of ATF. And then in 6 months, it requires a report to come from the FBI, ATF, DEA, and other entities to say, okay, how would you parse out the responsibilities that aren't duplicated to these other agencies? And then finally, after a year, the agency would effectively go away, and its functions as they remain would go to these other agencies.
Now, there are people who are saying, you know, hang on a second. The agency was without a director for several years. Let's give it a chance to turn itself around. What do you see as the argument there?
Well, it's true. They were without a director for 7 years, and B. Todd Jones came in as the director just within the past year, a little bit more than a year. And that has been the argument, not only of what's interesting is this proposal has generated opposition from both gun rights and gun control groups. So, groups that naturally tend to probably disagree about a lot on issues agree about this, but for slightly different reasons, we suspect. A point in terms of the director, it was 7 years. And the reason they didn't have a director for that long was about 8 years ago, Representative Sensenbrenner, among others, passed a proposal or a provision in the law that required that the director be confirmed by Congress, by the Senate. And that took a very long time to happen. In fact, through Republican and Democrat administrations, that was not able to be passed. Finally, Todd Jones came in. And what the folks are saying who are supporting keeping the agency and giving the director a chance is, hey, Hayes only had a year. On the other side, the folks who are critics are saying, well, look, I mean, Todd Jones was acting director for a period of time. He was in office the entire time that the Milwaukee operation happened. It was briefed repeatedly up at headquarters. So he had a chance during this time. And essentially, these operations happened on his watch, whether as acting director or permanent director.
Now, this isn't the first time that a politician has proposed eliminating the ATF. The last time it was 1993, Democratic Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Do you see the two efforts as being similar, or are they pretty much different animals?
Well, the bills are very different. I mean, Conyers' bill was just a reckless bill, but a very brief bill with not a lot of details as to how it would work, and it just dissolved the agency. And this was largely in reaction to what had happened in Waco. And this is the Branch Davidian standoff that happened, where a number of these separatist group were killed in this firefight, along with some agents from the ATF. So a really disastrous operation. Ruby Ridge, where there was a standoff with separatist Randy Weaver. It happened not too long before this. So there were a few of these really high-profile events that had happened. And Conyers, who's a Democrat, proposed this. It didn't go anywhere. And I should say that this proposal, as the time that it's being introduced in the legislature, anything's possible. But it would seem to have very dim chances at this point of passing. What's intriguing, though, from a from a sort of political standpoint, is that this proposal is getting some interest from both Democrats and Republicans, again, possibly for different reasons. Some of the Democrats and some of the left-leaning groups are suggesting that gun control is such an important function that leaving it within an agency that has had so many problems really diminishes the opportunity or the ability to regulate guns effectively. And they suspect that the FBI, there's a center called the American Center for Progress, is that their argument is, and they support this, is that the FBI would be much less vulnerable to political pressure from the NRA and other groups as the ATF is. And so there may be some interesting, sort of bedfellows coming together in this proposal. But at this point, all Sensenbrenner has is one sponsor. There's the bill still being circulated on the Hill, and it doesn't. I should say there is one provision too that has gotten the ire of some liberal groups, is that this bill does preserve a restriction on the public release of trace data, and that's been a lightning rod requirement on the ATF, and what that means is that the agency, and this would be the FBI if they took over that part of the ATF's operations, would not be able to disclose how many crime guns are sold by a particular gun dealer. And that information has been shielded from the public for about 8 years. That would continue under Sensenbrenner's bill.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've been speaking to John Dietrich, a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he's been working on an investigative series on the ATF called Backfire.
Time for Curious Wisconsin. One of the people who resisted Nazi Germany from the inside was Milwaukee-born Mildred Fish Harnack, a University of Wisconsin graduate who, with her husband, went to Germany and became increasingly involved in the dangerous politics of the times.
We'll hear her story now from Joe Waldinger, who produced a documentary about Mildred Fish Harnack for Wisconsin Public Television. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, how did Mildred Fish Harnack become so interested in German politics?
Well, I think part of it was where she grew up. At the time she was living in Milwaukee, it was the most German of American cities. It was also socialist politics. The fact that there was a socialist mayor, it was the largest American city that had a socialist mayor and a socialist city council. So there were left-leaning ideas from when she was a child, even growing up in Milwaukee. And of course, these were Germans who brought these political ideas to Milwaukee.
And were Mildred and her husband socialists themselves?
Well, you know, that's really hard to say. They were definitely left-leaning. They were progressive. Her family said that she became that way when she came here and got educated in Madison. But, you know, when they went to Germany, they saw a need and a need to fight against what Hitler was espousing to the German people. A lot of people would say, well, okay, she was communist. Well, she never joined the Communist Party. She had a very strong interest in Russia. But what she was interested in was women's rights at the time in Russia, equal pay for women, maternity leave, in the case of divorce, child support, maternity, time off, all those types of things that we don't really look as radical or as communist. She was more left-leaning, progressive, possibly socialist, never joined the Communist Party. She did join the Nazi Party, so I can tell people that, but she did that in order to continue to work to survive. So her politics were definitely left-leaning.
Was that unusual for a woman of that era to be that deeply politically active? And she also had not just anti-Nazi sentiments, she had feminist sentiments.
Absolutely. She was, as many people say, many years ahead of her time. You know, even with her name being a hyphenated name, she kept her maiden name when she got married. But she was very well known, educated woman. She had her master's degree. She was teaching at Berlin University, the first American to teach at Berlin University.
Was she there already before Hitler came to power in 1933?
She arrived in 1929. So she met her husband here, who was a German scholar. He actually went back to Germany without her after they had gotten married, and she joined him. Ended up in Berlin teaching. He was finishing his several degrees, one in law and one in economics, and then joined her in Berlin. So she saw the rise of what was happening there, and actually it's documented in letters. She wrote her mother almost every week, and the first letters were very much of, my life is full from sunup to sundown in Berlin. What a wonderful city. And then those letters started to change when Hitler came to power, and you could see she started even writing code, writing the opposite of what she meant.
Well, you said that she joined the Nazi Party undercover. Does that mean that she and her husband were spies?
Well, she joined the Nazi Party in order to keep a teaching job. Her husband refused and didn't join until 1937, which was like the last possible moment. He was a government employee, which was really unusual not to have joined the party until that late. But I would say, yes, that was part of the reason that they did it, if anybody questioned them. She was definitely providing, helping to provide the Americans with information. Her husband had economic information. He worked in the economics department in Germany. The Americans wanted to know where the Germans had their assets as they prepared for the war. Mildred was known to have traveled around Europe gathering documents in order to get Jewish friends out and even Jewish strangers out of the country. And we also know that the group that they were involved in, this resistance circle in Berlin, provided military information to the Russians.
And do we know if she came to the Americans, or if the Americans recruited her to provide that information?
It's an interesting story. Mildred was one of the first people to meet Ambassador Dodd and his daughter Martha Dodd when they arrived in Berlin. She actually met them at the train station. She was part of an American women's group there that welcomed them. Her and Martha Dodd, the ambassador's daughter, became very good friends, so she was often in the U.S. Embassy. And in later years, when the Americans were looking for financial information, they had an in because they knew that her husband worked in the economics department.
So World War II era Germany, Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler, it's dangerous stuff, right? How rough did it get for her while she was over there?
It got very rough. She lost a lot of weight. She was having a hard time getting enough food. But her friends always said the Harnacks were the first to give away their food and their medicine and whatever else someone needed. It got very tense for her. And at one point, Arvid bought her a ticket out, a boat ticket. He wanted her to leave. She said, absolutely not. My place is next to you. I'm staying here. There's still work to be done. And when she was arrested, that boat ticket was found in her purse.
People who knew her, I mean, did it make sense to them that she would have this devotion and this intensity against a known risk?
Well, it's funny. She came back to the States in 1937, and she was very hush-hush about what she was doing in Germany. She did not talk about the secret life that she had at all. And in fact, a lot of her family members believed that she had, quote, gone Nazi, which couldn't have been further from the truth. But she was very much aware of the risk. She was very much tormented by the long hours that they were putting in and the risk involved. And as women in this group, there were 18 women, which, again, is a very telltale sign of the important role that the women played in this group. They had the most dangerous roles. She was a recruiter. She also handled top secrets and information and relayed it from one point to the next. So, you know, trying to recruit someone, it's easy to get caught when you talk to the wrong person. And then also transporting secret papers. I mean, there's documentation and eyewitness accounts of rendezvous that she held in certain parks in Berlin with other people who were undercover.
And how did she get caught?
She got caught because of a Soviet blunder. The Soviets were desperate for information. Over the years, Arvid had had several contacts within the Russian embassy in Berlin. Stalin kept purging those people, though, and so those contacts kept changing. And at one point during the war, the Russians were desperate to get information, and instead of using their code names, they actually transmitted in code the Harnack's name and their address, along with two other members of the group and their address. And so about 9 months later, the Germans decoded this information, and there were the names and the addresses spelled out, not the code names that the Soviets had given the Harnacks.
Now, I understand that Hitler himself took a personal interest in Mildred's case.
It's true. We don't know exactly why. There's some speculation that they may have met at one point, and that meeting might not have went very well. She was well known in Berlin as one being the wife of this high-ranking German official. She had contacts in the U.S. Embassy. She was also an educated teacher, and people knew her in Berlin. They said she was tall and she was beautiful, and they believe Hitler may have wanted to meet her. And he went to the night school where she was at, and that meeting didn't go very well. There's no way that we can prove that this meeting happened, but it explains why maybe she was treated differently, held in isolation when she was in prison, not allowed to speak or interact with any other female prisoners. She was the only American in their custody at that time. And it's said that, you know, her sentence originally was 6 years prison, 6 years hard labor, and Hitler had to sign off on this, and he refused to, along with another woman who was German. Again, he was embarrassed. He was stunned by the size of this group and what information they had had, because they came from all levels of society, and Hitler, in his huge ego, thought, I am being supported by all Germans, and this group proved that he was not.
Do we have any sense of what her time was like in jail, in isolation, before she was executed?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Two of her cellmates, years later, one, Arvid had left a farewell letter for Mildred that he gave her on the night before their trial started, and Mildred passed that letter on to her cellmate, who 10 years after the war returned it to the Harnack family, because that was Mildred's wish. And this way, the Harnacks got in contact then with two people who had actually seen Mildred in prison, and they had talked about how sickly she had become, how she was treated differently than the other female prisoners, how she was held in isolation. But she also had a stub of a pencil and did a lot of writing, and that seemed to soothe her in her final days. But she had her hair had grown completely gray within a 4-month period of when she was imprisoned.
She was ultimately executed by beheading. Was that common practice for the Nazis at the time?
Well, there were 18 guillotines in operation at that time in Nazi Germany, but believe it or not, that was the most humane way of execution, is what they believed. Hmm. Her husband was actually hanged by a short rope, which was a Nazi torture technique specifically designed for this group because it prolonged the death. So the guillotine was actually viewed as something more humane.
So looking back on her life, what she sacrificed, how she died, what did they accomplish, she and her husband?
It's a good question. And I asked that question to a family member, and they said the only thing they were successful at is getting themselves killed, which in one sense, you can look at it that way, because they provided the Americans a lot of financial information. But the Americans were more interested at that time, not so much in what was happening to the Jews, but how this might affect the stock market in this country. And they also had warned the Russians 9 months before the Germans had broken their pact and invaded the Soviet Union. And Stalin thought it was a ruse. He thought it was propaganda. And so he completely ignored that information. So here's this great bit of information that may have changed the war, and the The Russians completely ignored it, although we do know that she did help people escape, get out of Germany. She provided comfort for those Jews who were left behind. We just don't know how many, so it's really uncertain how successful they were.
Joel, fascinating story. Briefly, what led you to follow this thread?
I was on a German-American journalism fellowship and went to former Gestapo headquarters, and there was her picture, and it said University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a brief paragraph about her, and I was like, who is this lady and why don't I know anything about her? Came back here to the States, did a little bit of research on her and found her there really wasn't much, but a day in Wisconsin public schools, September 16th, is a day of recognition, and a kid had kids in the public schools and they didn't know about her either, so that was my motivation to go out and find more.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about her.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Joel Waldinger. He produced the Wisconsin Public Television documentary, Wisconsin's Nazi Resistance, the Mildred Fish Harnack story. He joined us for this week's installment of Curious Wisconsin.
Venerable game show The Price is Right kicks off its 43rd season on Monday. Music is from that. That's the cliffhanger yodeling song, a longtime favorite here at the Ideas Network. The Price is Right is just one of the many long-lasting quiz show successes.
So we're taking a look at the enduring appeal of the TV game show, why the genre has stuck around so long, and we want to hear from you. What is your all-time favorite TV game show? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
Robert Thompson joins us now. He's professor of television and popular culture and the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we go into the history of the game show, what is it about The Price is Right that's kept it on the air all these years?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, it started in 1956. That's a long time ago. And it had a little break between 1965 and 1972. And then it came back in 72 as The New Price is Right. They didn't keep that new for too long. And it's been going ever since. And in so many ways, it's just one step away from a big, long info. I mean, it's a constant introduction of products and a couple of words about the great things about those products. Then people give you the prices of those products. This is about as close as a television series gets to being the same as the commercials that interrupt it.
And is that part of why game shows like that work? They're partly self-funding because the advertising is built right into the show?
Well, that certainly helps the economy of the game show. I mean, game shows tend to be really, for one thing, they're cheap to make because you, you know, the set isn't that expensive. You're paying a host and an announcer, but you're not paying the talent, which tends to come on down from the audience or someplace like that. So they are very, very inexpensive. I remember I was on the set of Bob Barker's Price is Right Now, and that wheel they used to spin before the age of HD television looked like something you could have made in your seventh grade arts and crafts class. It was like glittering numbers pasted onto a little drum.
Well, it looks so impressive on TV.
Yeah, it does. That was the great thing about pre-HD TV is you could make garbage look pretty good.
Well, and the show survived retirement. You mentioned Bob Barker. He left. The show's still there. How important in a game show is the host versus the game itself?
Well, I think the host is really important, although obviously not all important, because we went from Bill Cullen on The Price is Right to the classic Bob Barker and now to Drew Carey, and it's still going strong. The same with Jeopardy. Alex Trebek seems like he's been doing that forever, but once upon a time there was someone else hosting that as well. So I guess the game is more important insofar as a lot of these games have survived host changes. But at the same time, you can't just put any old person into that host position and expect it to work. The other thing, strangely enough, that I think is crucial is time slot. Game shows have had a long history of being on in prime time. Matter of fact, at one point in their history, game shows were the most popular shows of all on primetime. But they don't seem to be able to last as long. A game show that's on primetime can do really well, but it lasts a couple of years and it fizzles out. Then it can go into afternoon or, in the old days, morning, and it can seem to then last forever. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is a perfect example. It was a huge hit in 1996. 1989 and remained a huge hit for a few years. And then it fizzled on primetime, went to now the most cities you see it about 5, 6, 7 o'clock, and it could go forever. The same with Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune and Price is Right. The longevity seems to have to happen before 8 o'clock. When you cross that threshold, your lifespan speeds up really quickly.
So the game show flame burns brightest in primetime, but it burns out the fastest.
That's exactly right.
Well, you had mentioned to me earlier today that even, you know, you think of I Love Lucy as a dominant TV show, that actually had serious competition from primetime game shows?
Yeah, in the mid to late 1950s, the big money game show emerges on television, and we'll get to a second why it happened then. And when it emerged, audiences went completely crazy. The $64,000 question became such a hit that, first off, it knocked I Love Lucy out of the number one slot in the Nielsen ratings. And newspapers, including the New York Times, used to have little tables each day in the newspaper as to what contestants won how much money on which quiz shows the following night. I mean, this was tantamount to people going to the newspaper in the morning for sports scores. Huh. You had game show scores. The reason those emerged at that point is radio, back when radio was the dominant genre, when radio had game shows and soap operas and cop shows and all the rest of it before TV, quiz shows had been popular. And then federal communication rules named quiz shows where you won money to be to fall under the lottery laws. In other words, you weren't allowed to do them. Well, that got fixed sometime in the 1950s, and quiz shows that gave money were allowed again. And what the TV networks decided to do was take the ideas of the radio quiz shows and simply make them much, much huger stakes. So on radio, it had been the $64 question. For the TV version, they simply added three zeros to the $64 question. At its peak, if you lost the $64,000 question, your consolation prize was a brand new Cadillac. That was what you got if you lost.
Wow.
That shows you how big these things were. And in 1956, that was $64,000 was a whole lot of money.
Well, thinking about that and then that surge you mentioned of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, is that something that can capture attention for a while, a really big potential payoff?
Well, it can. I mean, I don't know if you remember back in the summer of 99, but I remember you could not go into a restaurant. And as you were seated, you heard people saying, "Is that your final answer?" from like every table that you passed.
True.
That had so totally penetrated the American idiom. And when it first started, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire would play like eight nights in a row, and then it would go away for a couple of months, and then it would come back. So that it was almost like you'd hear this was going to be on, and it was like you'd go on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire vacation. And for a while, all the top rankings of that entire week would be episodes of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. But like you pointed out, that it was a supernova, but it couldn't sustain itself, and it's still going now on daytime. But in primetime, it just didn't last.
And then the lower money shows that have a lot of staying power, Price is Right. I mean, if you win the big sweepstakes, okay, but we're talking small amounts of money through most of it. Jeopardy, not big payoffs on a daily basis. What is it about them that can keep the daily trickle of money going and still keep people's attention?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is that the kind of attention that we expect television to get from us is different at 5 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock in the evening, and different at 10 o'clock in the morning. In that, in a lot of cases, I think a good portion of the American public watches Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy in a different room from the television set in which it's on. And I know nobody, all of my students who now watch all of their TV on their laptops and tablets and so forth, I have never seen somebody watching Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy staring at a laptop. I mean, it seems to be one of those shows that's really a really popular show not to actually watch. You're in the kitchen preparing a meal. You're getting ready for the transition of the afternoon into the evening and whatever that might mean in a household with a lot of people. And in some ways, Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy is the perfect show not to pay that much attention to. The problem is when you put those things on in primetime is a time where we actually do pay attention to things. And if you pay too much attention to an episode of the of Wheel of Fortune or Price is Right, the whole thing collapses before your very eyes.
Let's go to a caller.
It's a bad painting. If you stay far away from it, it can look quite beautiful. If you start to scrutinize it, not so much.
Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Mike in Green Lake County. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your show?
Oh, it was Jeopardy with Art Fleming, the original host.
So do you
I remember my parents watching that.
Did you like him better than Trebek?
Well, I do because I remember the early show, the contestants were always like molecular biologists or nuclear physicists, or, and they were super, super difficult questions, and you felt that if you got any of the questions right whatsoever or even close to it, you were so smart.
Mike,
do you remember who the announcer was with Art Fleming?
Art Fleming.
Yeah, he was the host, but you remember who his announcer was?
Oh, I'm afraid I don't.
The late Don Pardo, last week or a couple weeks ago.
No way, I hadn't heard
that. That was my era too. When if I even hear Art Fleming's voice, I'm 7 years old, homesick from school, watching Jeopardy again.
Wow, thanks for sharing that, Mike. Sharing those memories. And Don Pardo, I hadn't heard he had passed away.
Yeah, just a few days ago.
And he stuck around into the Alex Trebek era too, didn't he?
Am I wrong? Did he go to Jeopardy? I mean, he certainly went to Saturday Night Live
right.
And all of that. I think he did. I think he did announce Jeopardy for in Alex Trebek as well. But I think of him as the Fleming era. Well, it's interesting now. Yeah, the caller pointed out an interesting thing. Whereas Jeopardy was always kind of the intellectuals game show or quiz show. And I always thought Jeopardy was, even though it wasn't nearly as hard as the questions back in the 50s, for the later era, it was almost, I think one of the reasons for success is you had all of those people starting after the Second World War who started going to college, who never would have before. So we had all these people with incredibly good liberal arts educations, and they would go on to become doctors or lawyers or accountants, things that you never really used your liberal education in. And Jeopardy was a way you could finally apply all of that knowledge that you got in college that you didn't really get much chance to apply in other places. You could at least feel smart in Jeopardy.
Pop culture expert Robert Thompson is with us from Syracuse University. He's telling the story of the history and the appeal of TV game shows as The Price is Right kicks off another in a long line of seasons.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been hooked on a game show? Have you ever been a contestant? What do you like or dislike about them? Ever been home marooned on the couch sick and couldn't stop watching game shows? What did you like about it? You can email talk at WPR.org or call 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Thompson of Syracuse University. He's a TV and popular culture expert there. And we're looking at the appeal of TV game shows with daytime legend The Price is Right kicking off its 43rd season on Monday.
And you can join at 800-642-1234. What's been your favorite TV game show of all time? What do you like or dislike about them? Do you watch them intently or are they background noise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk at WPR.org. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Appleton. Steve, hi.
How you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Steve?
Well, it's interesting you were talking about this particular subject because I'm connected to it in a couple of different ways. I was on a game show as a singer for 3 years, a show that was hosted by Tom Kennedy called Name That Tune.
No way.
I'm sure you're very familiar with that.
Oh, yeah.
So I was the boy singer on that. But more importantly, my last name is March Torme. I'm Mel Torme's son, but my stepfather is the guy you were talking about, the host of the $64,000 Question Show. I was brought up by Hal March.
No kidding. So you've got game shows in your blood. Do you have any inside secrets?
I'm afraid so.
Do you have any inside secrets from that experience to share with us to win if we get on one of these?
How do you get on? Well, you know, it's funny. You were talking about the fact that the country literally would come to a standstill to find out if somebody had won the $64,000. And as you mentioned back then, that was a huge amount of money. And we were living, I was being brought up in Westchester County, New York, and my dad told me, he said, yeah, they would actually interrupt the Yankee games towards the end to see who won. And that's how important they were. And, you know, people that I meet say, oh, isn't that the show that they did game show about? And I said, well, yes, kind of. And so they said, well, so was your dad on the take there? I said, no.
Okay.
My dad was a straight shooter. I said, but as soon as the $64,000 challenge went down, they just got scared and said, all right, you're all coming off the air because we just can't afford to have a scandal.
Steve, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And Robert Thompson, that quiz show scandal, can you talk about the impact of that? Tell us a little bit about it and the impact it had.
Well, first of all, having to be on the radio with somebody who was a singer on Name That Tune,
yeah,
that was a special moment for me.
Me too.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, the game shows, we don't realize that it was game shows that became one of the most important, influential moments in the history of American television. These things come on in the late 1950s. They become incredibly popular. 21, $64,000 Question, Tic-Tac-Doe, Dotto. And then all of a sudden, evidence begins to come out that some of these things are fixed from soup to nuts. In some cases, people had all of the answers in the beginning. Charles Van Doren, who had become a star, cover of Time magazine, he was hosting the Today Show thanks to his win on 21, then denies it and then comes back and says he was lying. And not only did the networks pretty much knock all the game shows off of primetime, not all of them, but most of them, but they all kinds of other rules came as well. They took over ownership of most of the nonfiction programming, changed the way that kind of thing was done. Most advertising now didn't do full sponsorship of single shows. It really changed the industry in significant ways. And from that time forward, people thought television was a lying medium, which many people to this day still continue to think.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Tom now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hello. I had told your producer that the two that I recall is was Concentration, and I think Hugh Downs was the MC on that, and then Hollywood Squares.
Oh.
Yeah. Hollywood Squares, if I recall the story correctly, is they taped, and I think all of them tape at one time, so they tape five shows in one day. And Hollywood Squares would break for dinner, and they'd basically all go out and have dinner and drinks. So the Thursday and Friday shows were after dinner, or taped after dinner.
Right.
And they were really quite funny.
Tom, thank you so much. They got a little loose on Thursday and Friday. I never knew why Paul Lynde was famous, but he was always there on Hollywood Squares back when I was a kid.
There was another show, The Match Game, where alcohol provided an important ingredient to its particular character.
Definitely. Thanks so much for sharing those, Tom. And Hollywood Squares, I mean, it brings on a bunch of celebrities from A to C list. How much of an impact does having a celebrity or a group of celebrities on your game show matter? That was big in the 70s, I feel like.
Yeah, it was. The Gong Show had celebrities, which was one of my own personal Dada favorites of that period. Hollywood Squares, The Match Game. And you had certain celebrities who many people didn't remember when their biggest fame started becoming game shows. J.P. Morgan, Charo to some extent. A lot of those people, everybody knew it by game shows and didn't even remember when they had been other things. Of course, Hollywood Squares was the peak of that because you had nine of them. And it really was there were comedy bits they would do that was all written for them. That was a pretty work-intensive program.
Hmm. Speaking of celebrities on shows, Rebecca in Milwaukee emailed to say, my favorite game show now is Hollywood Game Night. So much fun to watch. My friends and I get together into teams and do a lot of the games from this show ourselves. I haven't seen this. I've seen ads for it, Robert, where I think Jane Lynch is involved, right, Amanda?
Yeah. Right, yeah. It's based on a show, I think, in Australia. Anyway, that show has existed in other places, and it is more participatory. There's all kinds of other entertainment elements. And we're seeing some of that, too, on the games that Jimmy Fallon plays on Late Night. And in the old days, programs like Beat the Clock and Truth or Consequences resembled much more what we seem to see coming back a little bit in shows like Hollywood Game Night. That's primetime, by the way.
Yeah. So maybe we're due for another primetime renaissance. We'll go back to the phones with Robert now in Whitewater. Robert, hi.
Hello. I believe your guest name is Robert as well.
That's right.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Well, Robert, I used to live in Japan, where I was very intrigued watching a lot of the game shows in that country. And I just wanted to ask what you may know about game shows came from other countries, game shows that were popular in the United States or are popular, and maybe some American game shows that may have gone on to have a bigger life perhaps overseas.
Robert, thanks. Robert Thompson.
Yeah, well, first of all, one of our biggest, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, of course, came from the UK, as did The Weakest Link, if you remember that, which also burned very brightly for a very short period of time. So there was a while that we were looking overseas to find the next Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which started there. It's interesting you bring up the Japanese. They did the game show like nobody else, some of the kooky things. I think our Wipeout was based on a Japanese game show, and for a while we had a summer replacement, which was called, I think, the Japanese Game Show, if I'm not mistaken, or something much like that. But they came up with some really wild ideas going back as far as the 70s.
Well, as we look ahead, now daytime TV is kind of in flux now. Soap opera is a long-time struggle. Do you think game shows are going to be able to keep it alive there during the daytime hours?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was soap operas and game shows. There were a lot of game shows on daytime. Now it's pretty much Price is Right. The game show's big bastion now seems to be the fringe hours with things like Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy, but certainly not a whole lot of them either. We're in a position now where game shows have almost disappeared, but those that have stayed are really, really big hits. Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, their ratings are actually going up from year to year as opposed to down. So it's an odd situation. We culled the number about as far down as we could get, but the ones that are still alive are really healthy.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us. It's always fun to talk to you.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
It's Robert Thompson, professor of television and popular culture, director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Jeopardy's got to be my favorite. Just lots of questions, bang, bang, not a lot of drama. Veronica?
Jeopardy's fun, but you know, I'm a Price is Right. I spent so many hours as a kid watching the Price is Right.
Homesick from school, maybe?
Exactly. If only I could play Plinko, I'm sure I would win.
As a kid, I never had any idea what stuff at stores was going to cost, though, because I didn't do the shopping when
true.
I was seven.